Hey listeners, this is Travis Book, bassist and singer in the bluegrass band The Infamous String Dusters. I started the Travis Book Happy Hour to try to get to the root of what makes my contemporaries tick, what inspires and motivates them, and why they make music. It's an hour where we get to play together, talk about life, and do it all in front of a live studio audience. If you haven't listened yet, maybe check out some of my highlights, including Sierra Hull, Beppe Gambetta, Tim O'Brien, and Lindsay Liu. You can find every episode of the Travis Book Happy Hour on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or wherever you get podcasts.
And welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. Here I am. I am Cindy Howes. I host this podcast, and I very much appreciate you checking out today's episode, which is with the great John Hiatt. John Hiatt's latest is a collaboration with bluegrass musician Jerry Douglas, with Jerry as producer and his band as backup for Hiatt. John's digging into some serious past memories for these songs, which include a song about his older brother, Michael. Michael died by suicide when John was only 9, and it's only until now where he's chosen to write about the experience in his music in the song Light of the Burning Sun. Jerry knew that the material was very serious and approached it very lovingly with John and the band. On the pod, John expands on his grief and giving himself the time and space to mourn. We also talk about the importance of radio in John's young life. He would listen to WLAC radio from Nashville as a kid around 11 years old. There was a show on Sunday night where they'd have a gospel show and they'd go into a different black church every week and just broadcast the service. John has said, "Those gospel shows used to scare the shit out of me." That opened his world to a completely different way to relate to music in terms of faith. John picked up the guitar at 11 as well to cope with the trauma involved in being an overweight child. This was especially hard because he was a bigger kid at a time when it was rare for a child to be heavier. He discusses how music and surprisingly how drugs and alcohol helped him overcome his weight issue, which then, of course, the drugs and alcohol led to new problems in his adult years, requiring him to overcome that addiction and live a sober life. John talks about his kids, which includes the musician Lily Hiatt, the coolest. Lily said in an interview once, "I was crying over the fact that my career seems stalled and I wasn't the flavor of the month." And Dad said, "Lily, we will never be hip. We're just not those people." John's been a steadfast songwriter since the 70s, who's written many well-loved songs, including my personal favorites, Have a Little Faith in Me and Cry Love, and of course, Thing Called Love, which was covered by Bonnie Raitt very popularly. The writing on his latest album spans several decades and confronts some of his most vulnerable feelings. To be able to talk to John Hiatt about this project in particular was a sincere privilege, and I hope you enjoy. We'll take a listen to a song from John's new album. The song is The Music Is Hot, and then we'll get to our conversation with John Hiatt on Basic Folk.
As kids melt into the sky, you're making your moves, trying just to stay alive. And the music is hot. WSM on your transistor radio, a song about trains, you can hear the whistle blow. Waylon walks the line, Merle's mama tries to tell him so, and the music is hot. You got a story about 20 miles.
Well, thanks so much for talking to me, John. This is so exciting to have you on the podcast, so thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
I've read that you're a pretty private person. You don't like talking about, like, certain details, so I've tried to, like, keep that in mind.
My life's an open book, Cindy.
Okay.
Ask me anything.
All right, great. And I am going to ask you about your feelings, so hope you're ready.
I'm sorry. I can't go there.
Okay.
It's too scary.
I know. I agree. I agree. So. But I'm hoping that we'll all learn a thing or two by the end of this. So on the new record, Leftover Feelings, the song The Music Is Hot has a woman in the South listening to radio back in the day. And I want to hear about the influence and impact of listening to the radio for you, especially like growing up in a family of seven children. It sounded like the radio was like a real solace for you. So how and like I'm wondering like how the connection to radio has changed over the course of your life as like a young kid who just loved the radio and then as somebody whose music was then played on the radio.
What a terrific question. Radio was, that's how we heard music, folks from my era. And I grew up listening to just the local, I guess now you'd call it the Top 40 station. But in those days, Top 40 would be, you know, you'd hear Otis Redding, and then you'd hear the Rolling Stones, and then you'd hear, you know, the McCoys, Hang On Sloopy, and then maybe one of the more bluesy kind of rhythm and blues guys. And, you know, it was all mixed up. So it was kind of the golden era in a way. And for a kid from the Midwest, I mean, you know, to hear Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell singing Ain't No Mountain High Enough, you know, or it just was, it's like they were speaking to my heart. Mm. So, yeah, it had a tremendous impact on me. And I was trying to kind of mirror that, writing that song, The Music Is Hot, setting this woman, a single mother, raising kids, just trying to get by, and her inspiration being the great WSM radio station, which is the heavyweight country music station of the South.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how about as, like, you grew older, your relationship to radio, how might that have changed, like, as you became someone who's trying to get your music on the radio?
Well, even when I started writing songs when I was 11, I was trying to emulate what I was hearing. I'll never forget, for example, I think I was 65, I would have been 13, hearing like a Rolling Stone on the radio for the first time. I was sitting in the car. My mother had parked the car and ran into a drugstore to pick up a prescription. And I was so profoundly affected by hearing the song that my thought was that when she came back out, she wouldn't recognize me. So that's how transformed I felt by that song. But anyway, and then later I'll jump up a few years when I was my first record on Epic Records, which came out in 1974. So what was I, 22? By that time we had album rock, you know, and they would play whole albums on the local FM station. And there was one here in Nashville. I'd moved to Nashville when I was 18, and they were going to play my whole record. They had a program that featured local artists. And so I ran out and jumped into my Volkswagen van and turned the radio on and listened to it was the first time I'd ever heard myself on the radio.
Oh, that's exciting.
It was very exciting. It was profound.
One more question about the radio. I read that you used to listen to WLAC from Nashville when you were in Indianapolis. You were around 11, and there was a show on Sunday night where they would basically broadcast a gospel service from a different black church every week. And you had this amazing quote about it. You said those gospel shows used to scare the shit out of me.
Indeed.
Yeah.
I mean, I was singing in our choir at church, in the boys' choir, but we were singing a Catholic mass. It was still in Latin. So these people are carrying on and telling you what it was all about. And we were singing Kyrie Eleison, Gloria in Excelsis Deo, which I didn't even understand. Now, I was moved by it profoundly. I loved singing in the choir.
How did that music impact, like, that you would hear on the radio from those gospel services? How did that impact or open up your relationship to religion or to faith?
Well, I think it was kind of, later when I found that. Mm. Although I'm sure, you know, I had faith in the music, and that's God enough, I think. So, I had faith in this power greater than myself, music, and its ability to move people. And I remember listening to the show that I listened to on Sunday night was Hossman Allen, who was actually a white guy. And he was always, the various churches that would have him for the first time, they were always surprised to find out that he was a white guy because he sounded like a black guy. Mm. And I got to meet him actually later in my life, wonderful man. But yeah, he had a huge influence on me.
Mm. So you are from Indianapolis and grew up kind of being obsessed with racing in the Indy 500. It sounds like the drivers were as much as like rock stars as actual rock stars, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And the first track on the new album, Long Black Electric Cadillac, dedicated to an electric car. So I want to know, like, you know, like Neil Young loves those like real big honkers that are gas guzzlers. So he's been known to talk about trying to make those cars more green, but
He's made one. He made one. He took a Lincoln and electrified it. He calls it the Link Volt.
Oh my God!
Yeah,
that sounds great.
So it is doable, America. We can make a long black electric Cadillac.
Yeah, that song is great. And how has your love for cars evolved over the years? And like, where's your malleability landed when it comes to like new environmentally friendly cars?
Well, assuming the math works, in other words, the power it takes to charge these things, if we can do that in green way, I'm all for it. I love the idea of electric cars, and I'm hoping that that it's something that's going to work out for the world. I think it's, you know, as I say, I don't know the particulars of what it takes to charge these things, what kind of power it takes to do that, where do you get that power from, so on and so forth. So
yeah,
there's things I'm not that sophisticated, but I have ridden in one, and they're amazing. It's seamless acceleration. There's no gear shifting. It just goes. And you have the same amount of torque at 90 miles an hour as you did at 10. It's just incredible.
Wow.
I'm all for it. Long black electric Cadillac. I'll be at the dealership tomorrow as soon as they make it.
Also like a great opening for a John Hiatt and Jerry Douglas collaboration where it just starts off with his insane dobro playing. Like Jerry Douglas's dobro playing to me sounds like a unicorn riding on a rainbow.
That's great. I'm going to tell him that.
You should.
That's perfect. Yeah, he takes its places, that's for sure.
How did it feel to like, I know you love working with like musicians who use fretless instruments like Jerry and Rodney Crowell, but how did it feel, like how does it feel to like experience that kind of like out of this world sound alongside your songs?
Levitating. Yeah. It was like walking on clouds, you know. We had so much fun making the record. We did it in 4 days. And, just, you know, the arrangements were off the floor. It was all live. There were just a couple of overdubs after the fact. I remember, Christian Stettelmeyer and Daniel, the bass player, did a little string quartet on the song Buddy Boy. That was an overdub, but the performances were all of a piece and recorded live in the RCA Studio B.
You actually have like a knack for banging out albums in a very short amount of time. Like you said, this record recorded in 4 days. And it's interesting to think about your time at Tree Music Publishing Company in Nashville when you were 18 years old writing songs. Which you wrote and recorded 250 of them. And how did that like early experience of recording all those songs so quickly affect the way you work in a studio?
I think it was a wonderful experience. You know, they had a little tiny, it was a four-track studio. And a young guy named Eddie, I can't think of his last name, ran it, engineered it. And I'd be in there as much time as I could get. I'd be in there. And it was basically just a vocal booth and then a little tiny room where you could set up a little two-piece drum kit, maybe. But I'd be stuck in that vocal booth just making guitar vocal demos as quick as I could write them. And I think it gave me the opportunity to be at ease, you know, in a recording setting, and also to get used to hearing myself sing, because it's an awful thing to hear yourself sing when you first do it. Rodney Crowell came by the studio the other day when we were doing some filming, and he walked up to me and he said, "Have you gotten over hating your own singing voice yet?" And I said, "Well, you know, I've made my peace with it. Let's put it that way."
Yeah.
So, yeah, he I thought that was funny, because it is odd, you know, to hear yourself.
I wanted to ask you about the song "Light of the Burning Sun," which is about your brother Michael's death. You said, which he died by suicide when you were 9 years old, and you said the thing about a traumatic event in one's life is that it sort of packs its bags and moves into your psyche, and so it can take some time to get over that and to make peace with that. Can you talk about giving yourself the time to make peace there, and what it was like to face the grief of Michael, like before you wrote that song and afterwards?
Well, it's he took his own life when I was 11, and there were seven of us. He was the oldest, and my mother's firstborn. She adored him, of course. He worked for my father, unhappily, as it turned out. But it's as you spend your life learning how to live, so I've spent my life learning how to live with a tragedy like that happened, mm-hmm. In my family. And you talk about the bags sort of, they sort of get packed and come along with you. And it's kind of what you have to do is sort of start unpacking the bags as you go along and as you're ready and willing and however much help you can get or need. And find, you know, take a look at the clothes that are in there, and, you know, what fits, what's you, put you can wear it, and what's, you know, you, grief is, you know, it has its own schedule, so it can take forever, and it's okay, but it was great to finally write a song about it, and it's a very factual, just an accounting of what took place. And it kind of came out all in a piece, as I recall. I wrote it, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years ago. And so I was kind of, there was a great deal of relief to just getting it down. And also, I like the idea that I can connect now, possibly because of the song, with other people who've had this experience. And so, you know, It's another way of connecting with humanity. So you got to deal with the grief and the hard stuff as well as the joy and the happiness.
Definitely. And I think that's like one great service that artists and songwriters give to us, is that you are able to put your feelings out there in a way that makes us feel less alone. So it's much appreciated.
I think most of us feel that that's the special link that we are so grateful to, because I'm like a lot of typical singer-songwriter, you know, connecting with people is not my long suit in terms of, you know, I'm not particularly outgoing or anything. I'm kind of a shy guy. So it's kind of like, who was the character that... imagine doing all these great things back in the 50s. I can't remember his name, but a lot of my world is imaginary. And to be able to, so this writing songs allows me to connect with the big we.
I have one more question about that song, and then I want to ask you more questions about your songwriting. Jerry approached that song very lovingly with you and his band, and you and Jerry have known each other in a professional capacity, and this is the first time you're working together. But I imagine that there were times like this where your relationship grew like exponentially. So what did his approach mean to you, especially on that song, and how do you think that experience deepened your friendship?
Well, you know, I think you hit it on the head. We've known each other professionally, but we're just now actually becoming friends through working on this record. And I was so touched with the kindness, the way he handled the song, and urged me to record it. I didn't even want to record it. Mm. You know, I was a little leery. I thought, Jerry, geez, this is so dark, you know. And he said, no, people need to hear this. You know, he was encouraging. So it was a very loving, kind thing for a friend to do. That's what it felt like to me.
And when you are writing your lyrics, I have heard that you write the melody first and the lyrics kind of like reveal themselves to you while you're messing around with the music. Like you said, you've just got to jump inside and take the ride. So given that, what has that taught you about processing your feelings and experiences through songwriting?
Well, that's the well, you know, you go to when I've got a little chord pattern and a melody maybe that I'm goofing around with and a rhythm gag, you know, it's a lot about the rhythm too, that kind of dictates. And then it's like, you might even in singing nonsense, oftentimes I'll sing a line that makes sense and I'll go, oh, that's what I'm going to write. That's what this song's about, you know. So that can happen. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. Just thinking about how the lyric allows me to connect with. It's not just my feelings. It can be something I've read or a story that was told that I'm retelling. You know, stories is what we have as human beings. You know, 'twas always thus. I mean, we've told stories since the beginning of time. So it's just one, it's the same story probably. We just retell it.
Yeah.
You know? The fish gets bigger or smaller, but, you know.
One of my favorite songs of all time is Cry Love. In the lyrics, it sounds like, so I was listening to it today, and after like reading all of your history, correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like you are taking responsibility for your part in something and pointing out your shortcomings. Does that sound right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's the character is a woman who's been hurt, you know, and I've hurt people in my life for sure. Didn't want to.
Right. But. So facing that kind of realization, I think, takes a lot of humbleness and humility and just facing shame, you know, like what was the process like of understanding your faults in situations and what was it like to express that so publicly in songs?
Well, for me, the only way I've ever been able to make peace with all that stuff is by writing a song about it. You know, it's like my version of journaling, I guess, if you will. I know that helps a lot of people just to write stuff down. You know, to put pen to paper. Or in my case, fingers to my iPad nowadays because I can't read my own writing. It's how I figure out the emotional landscape of a given period of my life or events or what other people I know are going through or you know, yeah.
I just love that. I mean, I just love it when. People are. I'm reading Brandi Carlile's book right now, which I'd recommend. And I'm reading the beginning of it. And I'm like, she sounds really difficult, really tough. but I'm also thinking that, like, I really like that in songs when people are like, hey, I messed up and I was a jerk and I admit it. And,
yeah.
And, you know, as the book is going on, I'm like liking her even more and more and more. But I love it when somebody can do that in like a 3-minute song.
You know, I've been married to my wife for 35 years as of June 6th, this weekend.
Oh, congrats.
And if we can't admit, if you can't cop to your stuff, a marriage isn't going to last very long. So I've learned, I've got a good teacher.
Okay, so here is where we learned that we lived parallel lives for a little while. So you were an overweight child, as was I.
Yes.
An overweight Catholic child, as was I.
Uh-oh.
Yep. So I really relate to that experience. And you learned to play guitar when you were 11 because you were a fat – you said you call yourself a fat kid.
I did, which is not – I know it's not sensitive.
It's like –
that's what I felt like.
Totally.
Yeah.
It's sort of like trying to make a joke out of it so you don't really have to talk about it. But
that's exactly it.
Yeah. You wanted to have friends. You wanted to be loved. And that was the thing that you reached for. So I was actually talking to my friend and trainer who says they were saying that children who experience the trauma of being overweight tend to be healthier adults, which I also totally relate to. But I'm wondering, like, how does that experience of, like, being an overweight child follow you around, and how does that resonate with you? Like, how does health resonate with you these days?
That's a lot. I was overweight. I weighed, by the time I was 15, I weighed 320 pounds.
Mm.
Food was just the way I consoled myself and stopped all the crazy stuff that was happening around me from happening. I literally was trying to get big enough so that nobody could come in and hurt me anymore. Mm-hmm. So that was what was going on. And thank goodness I found music when I was 11. Also, thank goodness I found alcohol when I was 11. And the combination really, really saved my life. I mean, I'm grateful for both of them. I'm happy that I don't have to drink and take drugs anymore. But it got it that period. It was important because it fueled. It was a way for me to get out of that situation, and I could drink and feel better about myself.
Mm.
So, and the music, of course, was very soothing. Later, of course, alcohol turned on me. I got sober when I was 32. So it took a minute. But I think you build them. I think it's previous, formerly overweight people. I think it builds empathy in a person. You know, I understand. And when I was overweight, we're talking the early 60s. It was a little more unusual to be overweight in America back then. It's not quite as unusual today.
Growing up in the 80s, it was hard to find like clothing and stuff that.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I mean, you know, I went to Catholic school and the boys didn't have uniforms, but they all dressed the same. And of course, I couldn't buy the same clothes that they were buying. And people couldn't for other reasons. They couldn't afford them and so on and so forth. But, I was at the big and tall shop and all that stuff. Exactly where I didn't want to be.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But there I was. So, but you learn, you know, I think you learn it's a life lesson, you know. And as far as, you know, I've had body image issues my whole life. It's just, but in the last couple of years, I've gotten pretty easy going about it all, you know, and I may have been maintained my weight essentially for the last 25 years. So,
it's no small feat.
No. And you have to work at it every day. You know, I have to have I'm good. I'm not good when I'm bored or left to my own devices. I have to have a kind of things that happen to every day in a little bit of an order. so that I can, you know, I feel comfortable that way.
Your daughter, Lily Hyatt, is a really successful and very cool musician. And you were a single dad with Lily for a short amount of time. But I was wondering if you could talk more about your connection with her, you know, keeping that in mind when she was growing up.
Well, she lost her mother, her birth mother, to suicide in 1985. She had just turned 1 year old. And I subsequently moved, she and I, to Nashville. And I was within the first year of being here, I met my my wife. I was the last person on earth looking for anything like a relationship, much less getting married again. But it was meant to be. So, and my wife had an 8-year-old boy, my stepson Rob, and Lily was 2 at that time, and we were married in 1986, and it was as if, you know, it was as if we were kind of guided. Almost like, you know, somebody was saying, you know, you guys apart, I don't know if you're going to be able to pull this off, raising your kids apart. But mm-hmm. I think if we put you together, you got a crack at it. So that's what happened. And 2 years later, we had Georgia Ray. And these kids are amazing. They're the finest people I know. And they love each other. You know, that doesn't always happen in a blended family, I'm mm-hmm. told. So we were delighted at that. And every time we see them, they're just delightful people. We're very, very proud of them.
Yeah, I read this really great interview that you and Lily did together. And she said, I was crying over the fact my career seemed stalled and I wasn't the flavor of the month. And my dad said, Lily, we will never be hip. We're just not those people.
Yeah.
What did you mean?
Yeah,
by
we're
that?
Not. We're yeah. not. And it's just fine. Yeah.
When did you reckon with that, and how did it feel to draw that conclusion?
Oh, gosh. I guess it took time. I'm hopeful that I can say sometime in the last 20 years the penny dropped and I just kind of, you know, it's okay. I get what I do, and I'm very happy to do it, and I feel grateful to be able to do it, and that's what it's about, you know, at the end of the day. So yeah.
We were talking about empathy a little bit earlier, and I really wanted to ask you this question about being a man in the music industry who's made some very masculine sounding music over the years, but you've also made some more sensitive sounding music. And if one zooms into your songs, there's a softness there, even in the rough songs. And you've written from the perspective of women and have had women transform your songs to a female point of view, like Bonnie Raitt, most notably, Thing Called Love. So how has this experience of expressing sensitivity impacted your maleness and your ability to empathize with non-males?
Well, I was the last boy at home with 3 sisters and my mother. And at the time, I hated it. But now, and for many years, I'm forever grateful. I learned so much about the female perspective and my own feminine qualities, if you will. Mm-hmm. I think we have both, you know. And so, what I didn't have was, my father died when I was 13, so I really had no guide for how to become a man. So that took me a long time because I didn't have, I refer to this often, simple things. Like I used to watch the little boys at the sporting events, and they'd be in the restrooms in between, you know, the action with their dad, and the dad would be showing them how to use a urinal, you know. And I would look at that and go, nobody ever taught me that. I mean, just basic, you know, functional maleness. I didn't have a guide. And my father died when I was 13, which is when boys need a father the most. Mm-hmm. You've hit puberty. You don't have a clue. Raging hormones. You're crazy as a bed bug. And you just need somebody to help you, navigate. And Pop wasn't there. But I had sisters, and they loved me. And, the summer I spent in my bedroom listening to Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, you know, and didn't come out, they put up with that, and they humored me, and they were warm at the times I did come out for a meal or whatever. Yeah. You know, they didn't act like, what are you, crazy? You know, so just things like that. So I developed a great deal of respect for the female points of view and empathy and also just the give and take of male female relationships. But as I say, it took me a long time to grow up mm-hmm. in terms of becoming a man, and I'm not even sure I know what that is, but I'm still growing.
Yeah.
But yeah. It's good.
Your music has ridden the scope of many genres over your career, with a few albums notably Crossing Muddy Waters, and now with Leftover Feelings, a few albums being seeped in folk and bluegrass influence. How have you found that particular sound of bluegrass and folk helpful in expression of the song's meanings?
I love that setting. I love fiddles, and Christian Settlemyer, who played on this record, is just so amazing. Mm. He's steeped in the bluegrass tradition, but he can play anything, just unbelievable. And Daniel Kimbrough, the upright bass player, same thing. He can bow his double bass like a symphony guy, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, and yet he'll boom, boom, boom with the best of them on any bluegrass tune you want to call out. So, and Jerry, of course, just unbelievable, you know, virtuoso. But they all have soul. They all know how to play songs. But yeah, I remember hearing Tut Taylor when I came here in 1970. He was kind of the king dobro player in Nashville at that time, I guess after Josh Graves. I remember hearing him at the old time picking parlor and just being amazed at the sound of that instrument and how it speaks and sings, and just wonderful.
The new album has no drums.
That is correct.
That is correct.
The drummer blew up.
I hear Jerry wanted the drummer.
Jerry wanted the drummer, and I said, why don't we do it without the drums? I don't know why. I just felt like, you know, I'd made that record that you mentioned, Crossing Muddy Waters, which was bluegrass-ish, you know, had the similar kind of flavor, acoustic instruments, and no drums on that, although we mic'd Davey Farragher, the bass player's foot. He stomped. So we had that. But I just felt like we could really get something and make the rhythm ourselves, you know. But these guys are so, I mean, I'm a rhythm guitar player, and I fancy myself, you know. I can, as they used to say back in the day, scrum a cushion.
What?
I can scrum a cushion.
Scrum a cushion.
Yeah, that's a good rhythm jag on a record, R&B record from the 60s. You know, if you started noodling, the producer would come on and go, just scrum a cushion.
Oh, my God. All right, I'm going to use that in real life.
Yeah, scrum a cushion. Yeah, don't be all up in the Welsh Corgi, up standing on the hind legs. just scrum a cushion.
So how did it feel to establish the beat without the drums? Sounds
just
like it was
wonderful.
Pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, all of us are, all stringed instrument players are frustrated drummers probably anyway, you know. And I know I started out beating on pots and pans before I picked up the guitar, you know. Drove my mother crazy, you know.
It's funny to think that you were a loner back in the 70s when you first got to Nashville. But since then, you've tended to thrive on collaborations with, you know, with Jerry on this record, working with Rodney Crowell and Nick Lowe. How have you noticed these types of collaborations changing you, and how has it impacted your relationship to performing?
Well, every record is a new adventure, and getting together a group of players is, you know, the next big exciting moment to us, to me anyway, a singer-songwriter. The thought of, what would this group of musicians make of these songs, you know? And so then to take that out and play it is sort of like, you know, the cherry on top of the whole deal. This is why we do it, you know, so we can go out and perform, play the songs, make the connection, you know.
You have to be, like, so confident in your songwriting abilities to, like, throw it at all sorts of different collaborators.
Well, I've been really lucky that, you know, I've been able to play with some great players, and that's just, most of the time I'm scratching my head going, how did I land in this tall of cotton, you know? So
probably from scrumming the cushion.
Kind of scrumming the cushion, I guess.
The song Little Good Night is the oldest song on the record, about your youngest baby, who is now 33 years old.
33.
Georgia,
yep,
Rae.
She was one of those what they called colicky babies. And we nearly lost our minds. Mm-hmm. But finally, at about 3 months, she started sleeping. It's like a switch went on. Or off, as the case may be.
So what was it like to revisit that song about parenting such a young baby?
It was wonderful. You know, I'd made a demo of it that many years ago, but I never put it on a record. And I sent it to Jerry as a group of songs to consider, and he said, we got to record that. So he said, every parent's been through that, for goodness sake.
Yeah, it sounds
with
like
at least one child.
It sounds like Jerry, like, you gave him, how many songs did you give him to check out?
I think about 15, 14.
Were you surprised at the songs he selected?
Well, Light of the Burning Sun surprised me.
Mm. Yeah. And also, you recorded at RCA Studio B, which, if people are unfamiliar, it's this ultra-historic space. Elvis Presley recorded hundreds of songs here. There are tours that go through the studio, but luckily you guys didn't have to deal with that because of the pandemic. Well, I guess not luckily because of the pandemic, but anyways.
But it was our good fortune.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
And you said it's just like this big old warm smile that wraps around you. You can just hear all that music coming out of the walls. So what was the role of Studio B in the album, and how did the space help shape the record?
Well, it has its own sound, you know, and if you hit it right, if you set the mics up right, it's like having a sixth musician, you know, playing along with you. And that's the way recording studios were built back in those days. They weren't meant to be acoustically neutral rooms that added no color. They were meant to add color. The idea was to, if you set the mics up right and dealt with the eccentricities of the room, acoustically speaking, that you'd wind up with something larger than the sum of the parts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would come out a little bigger, a little better. And this was before all the digital stuff that you can do in a computer now, which is all amazing. But this is the old way, where you let the room give what it has to give.
Nice. Okay, you have had songs and references to dogs in your music. What has the companionship of a dog meant to you? And can you talk about your favorite dog?
Oh, I don't play favorites with dogs, much like I don't play favorites with my kids. I've loved them all, and they've all brought different, you know, stuff to the table. So we've had dogs. I've had dogs. I had dogs when I was a kid. I grew up with a couple of Weimaraners, and then in my marriage to my wife, we lived on a farm for 25 years, so we'd have four or five dogs at a time. We've had Great Danes. We've had rescues of all stripe and color and look and shape and size. We've had, Jack Russell Terriers. We've had Pitties. We've had all kind of dogs. All dogs go to heaven. We currently have a he's a cross, a West Highland Terrier and a Maltese. He's all of 11 pounds, and we named him Spanky. And he was a rescue from a breeding operation that went south. Mm. He spent his first 16 months in a cage. So he's been traumatized, and we told him, well, you fit right in to this family, so come on. And he's just the sweetest little dog. My wife and I look at each other and go, if you'd have told us at any time in our married lives that we'd wind up with a wee white dog, we'd have laughed.
Yeah.
But that's what we have, and he's a sweetheart.
Yeah. All right, John, can we do one more thing before we let you go?
Yes.
Okay, this is called the lightning round.
Yeah.
Here we go. What was the first song you learned on the guitar?
It's a song I wrote. As soon as I had two chords, I wrote a song. It's called Beth Ann.
Oh.
And it was about a sixth. We were in fifth grade. She was in sixth. She had developed a little more than the other gals, so we were all paying attention to her. And it went, Beth Ann, ooh, she's a woman. That was my first song. Yeah.
How do you take your coffee?
A little cream and a little monk fruit sweetener.
Who is your first celebrity crush?
Oh, wow. Gidget.
Who's the nicest musician you've ever met?
Well, Nick Lowe's a sweetie.
He is so nice. I met him one time. He was great.
Yeah.
Good choice. What was your first concert?
The Yardbirds.
What?
At a 100-seat club in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Wow.
And it was either Jeff Beck or Jimmy Page on guitar. I think it was Jeff Beck. And, Over Under Sideways Down.
What was the last book you read, or what is a book you're reading right now?
I'm reading a book that's not in front of me, but it's a mystery by a Scottish writer, and it's just marvelous. And I wish my poor brain. It's great, though.
Beatles or the Rolling Stones?
Oh, Rolling Stones and Beatles. How can you choose?
Good point. Would you rather be able to fly, or would you rather be invisible?
I'd love to fly. That'd be spectacular.
Okay, this is the last question.
Okay.
Where is the most beautiful place you've ever visited?
We were up on a mountain in Switzerland, did a show, and I can't remember the name of the place, but it was spectacular. The most beautiful views I'd ever seen. Yeah, so somewhere in the Swiss mountains in the summer. In the summer.
Good.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Well, John, thank you so much for taking the time and answering all my questions about
your pleasure. It was fascinating and wonderful. Thank you, Cindy. I appreciate you.
Thanks. Yeah. All right. Take care, guys. Bye. Basic Folk this week was produced by the one, the only, Sarah Siplak. Our music is composed by Alex Stanton of Townspeople. Basic Folk is on the American Songwriter Podcast Network. I am your host, Cindy Howes. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, share it with them, and they can get it wherever you found this podcast or at basicfolk.com. And we'll talk to you next time. Okay, bye.